Is everybody familiar with the kind of social gaming model that has become probably the most prominent out there? Virtual currency, virtual goods. Yeah, okay, so I'll just go over it real quickly. The basic idea, you build a virtual economy, you get the users addicted to the gaming experience, right? So you have a very addicting, very immersive gaming experience from the very beginning. You get them very excited about playing the game, leveling up in the game, and then you make it increasingly difficult to progress in the game, and you make the virtual currency increasingly scarce. And with increased scarcity comes increased possibilities to monetize. So as the user wants the currency more, has a harder time getting there, then you can get them to interact with advertising. You can get them often to pull out their credit cards and make a payment. And that is the way that Zynga has made billions. And we're seeing a little bit of that on mobile. Mm-hmm. There are some companies out there experimenting with virtual economies on mobile. I wouldn't say there have been any home runs yet. The that have tried virtual currency on mobile?
Yeah, there's a couple big ones. I mean, the big games are the ones you've probably heard of, like Smurf Village, Wii Rule. And I mean, Smurf Village is kind of famous. And it's actually really interesting, right? Like, so Smurf Village is a really interesting example of this because Smurf Village made quite a lot of money. But it made quite a lot of money because it didn't have basically warning notifications on currency purchasing. Yeah. So one of the things that happens, and I think one of the things to think about when you move your game around is that one of the applications of a mobile or tablet device is that it functions for a family. And one of the uses we see with iPads, one of the reasons why there are honestly so many children's books on iPads, and there's a ton of them, is because a lot of people will use their iPad with their family. They'll just hand their iPad to their kid to play with. So if you don't block the currency purchase of Smurf Berries in Smurf Village, and the kid finds the button, for Smurf Berries, there's nothing stopping that kid from spending $500 on your credit card,
yep.
Which is actually what happened. And that created not so good press. So that's like, I think that's really kind of the interesting thing to me about this whole topic of companion gaming is that that's something that you wouldn't think about that much on a website, because the process of making a payment on a website is laborious enough that you're never going to have a kid like figure out, like a 5-year-old kid is never going to figure out your credit card number and your 3-digit security code on the back of the credit card, and then okay through 3 buttons to get the Smurf Berries. But if I can just touch the phone, and iTunes has got a 1-click purchase process, then yeah, that can happen. And it kind of sent a bit of a shudder through the whole slow growth sim market on the phone, because the press around that was so bad.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, so yeah. There's also advertising on mobile too, and
there's plenty of it,
and it does pretty well from everything I've heard. The people I know who work in that space report click through rates that are quite good. So there is that possibility as well. And then obviously, if you're talking about, there's obviously a paid application model on the phones, which I think everybody who has an iPhone knows how that works. And then basically on the consoles, there's still a large expectation that you're going to buy the disc. Downloadable content does well, but not terrific. Steam does very well for Steam and is very good for indie developers.
Yes, they do.
You know, if you ever wonder why Valve puts out its games much slower now than they used to, it's because they make so much money from Steam that they don't have to put out games anymore. So that's like one way that these platforms are different. And if you're looking to monetize a brand across platforms, you really have to be sensitive to that. And it leads to these kind of bizarre arrangements. I think the one that I find most fascinating is the HD phenomenon in the iOS space, mm-hmm. right? Where like you can take a game and you put it on the iPhone and you charge 99 cents for it. But you take the same game and you put it on the iPad, and effectively what you do is you just double the size of the art. So it won't letterbox on the iPad, and then you can charge like $4 for it.
Yeah.
And it's exactly the same application. Which is sort of an interesting, maybe not 2 times, maybe a little bit bigger. but it's like an interesting phenomenon where like what markets will bear is different, and you don't want to kind of like walk into the space with the expectation that like you're just going to handle it. Or you can just like move things cross seamlessly because that is a difficulty. And similarly, I think like the difficulty that Facebook presents with Facebook credits is, you know, is
it's
not
enormous.
The same thing as, yeah. as like a one-click process on the iPad.
Yeah, I mean, I think Facebook credits has been, I'm a little hesitant to say this, but I think it's been more or less a bust. They have not realized the potential that was there with Facebook credits because they screwed it up so badly.
And how did they? I mean, I think this is interesting. How did they screw it up?
Well, two main things. They made Facebook credits the primary currency rather than allowing publishers to use their own currency. And the problem is people who are in a game, they're playing Farmville, they want Farmville credit. They don't want Facebook credit. And it was this process where you had to buy Facebook credits and then convert that into another credit, and it was just very awkward. And I think ultimately their goal was to compete with PayPal. They wanted to create a global currency.
Right.
And that's why they did that, I think. Since then, they've remedied that. You can now buy the in-app currency directly. But the second problem, and this problem has not been fixed, is that the price of one credit is 10 cents. And that makes it extremely difficult for advertisers who are trying to tie into the Facebook credits economy because our ads are often 3 cents. There's 3 cent engagements, which is awesome at scale. You've got a ton of users who are willing to engage with advertising in exchange for some kind of a reward. And if you do that a couple hundred thousand times, you're doing pretty well for yourself. But with Facebook credits, we can't. We cannot buy a Facebook credit with a 3 cent transaction. You just can't do it. And so we're forced to go to advertisers and say, you know, we would love to work with you guys on Facebook, but we have to charge you 3 times the price in order to get on the credits platform. And nobody does it. So,
yeah, Facebook is having, it's becoming increasingly difficult for everybody in the ecosystem, except Zynga and Disney and I guess Six Waves. To really participate in Facebook in a meaningful way.
Yeah. You know, the other issue is that Facebook didn't start charging the 30% tax from the very beginning. And Apple did that, and that was very smart of them because people built an ecosystem of games around that tax, and it works. Facebook came in and started charging it later. They had all these companies that had built business models thinking that they were going to continue to make money the way that they were making money. And then all of a sudden Facebook said, well, we're going to take 30% of all of your revenue. And, you know, and that was Zynga's profit margin. Right.
Basically.
So,
yeah.
So there was, you know, the last couple financial reports I've read of Zynga's are not so hot because of that.
So just to elaborate on that a little bit, what ends up happening is that the whole Facebook games explosion really was based on one very simple premise, and that is you can buy traffic for virtually nothing or get it for free and then essentially monetize each user at a very, very low rate. But essentially, if every user is free and you monetize something off them,
yeah,
then it works, right? The problem is a lot of these companies, when they're looking at it, the lifetime value of users was probably something in the pennies. The moment that switches around, now you have a 30% tax on that, and now you've got to go out and buy traffic at double, triple the rates. Now, all of a sudden, the math goes off, and you've got 80% of the people putting games on Facebook. Now I have to sit there and go, what's my model? I have no idea what I'm going to do now.
And the only ones who can win in that model. The problem is that Facebook has also created a very exclusive environment,
right?
Because the only ones who win in that model that they've created are the ones who already have the traffic.
Yeah.
And
right.
So because Zynga has such a huge network, they have an inherent ability to cross-promote across their games.
Right.
So if you've got, you know, a couple million people on one game, it's pretty easy to get those people over to another game. But getting people into the network in the first place is very difficult. So those companies that have lots of traffic already are naturally going to win the war. So,
So the question was, what was the revenue split prior to the 70-30 split?
Yeah. So prior to that, Facebook didn't understand when they launched the platform in 2007. They didn't understand the beast that they had on their hands. They really didn't. Oh, it was the Wild West. Oh, yeah. No, our lawyer loves to use that term. He's like, yeah, this is the Wild West. You guys are forging new ground. Yeah, it was totally the Wild West. When Facebook launched the platform, there were no controls over sharing. There were no controls over there were no rules about how you had to design an app. You saw a bunch of really ugly apps that were unbelievably viral because people were optimizing basically just their sharing experience, their user invite experience, forcing people to invite before they could get into the app, and you know, really dirty stuff like that. And they didn't even understand, because virtual currency didn't exist. Nobody had really done it. And so Facebook didn't understand at the time that they had the opportunity to start a credits ecosystem and charge a 30% tax. Nobody had done it. And that was really, it was really Apple that forged that, you know, you create a platform and you tax the platform. And they were the first ones to do it successfully, I think. And Facebook then went, well, I want a piece of that. And they taxed everybody on their platform and pissed everybody off.
Well, I mean, at least a kind of an interesting question in my mind, and I wonder if you have an opinion about this. I have one. I can volunteer it, but I'm kind of curious as to whether you think it's necessary that if you have a brand and you're going to distribute that brand in a broad way, is it necessary to monetize on all parts of that brand? Like, is there ever a reason why you wouldn't want to monetize on parts of the brand, or you wouldn't have a focus to be to monetize on part of that experience?
I don't think it's necessary to monetize in all places. I definitely don't think that, because I think every, if you're on multiple devices, you know, your users can interact with your brand in multiple ways. I mean, it all depends on the goal of your specific brand and what you want the user experience to be. And I think monetizing too aggressively is dangerous. Monetizing not aggressively enough is dangerous. So, if you can't find a meaningful way to monetize on a mobile device, for instance, but you know you're monetizing well on the main experience, which is on Facebook or wherever, then you know, great. I think every game, every situation is different. So, yeah. Do you have a? Or, go ahead, Eric.
I'm kind of in agreement. I guess we've agreed all throughout the panel, and I guess we're going to do that the same here. But yeah, it's. If we're going to, in our space, we run video ads, right? So if somebody's going to sit there and watch a video ad for 60 seconds, there better be compelling content behind it. And sometimes a lot of these little apps on mobile phones, like the World of Warcraft app, great example, right? Mm. You can look up your friends. Is that valuable enough to put ads on? Probably not, yeah. Right? It's got to be compelling enough. Otherwise, people will not sit there and watch a 60-second video unless, you know, there's something compelling about the video itself.
So let's talk about the World of Warcraft app, because I think World of Warcraft is a really interesting example of a game that has tried this strategy as like to not create a similar experience. You know, because I think there's like there's a few ways this is happening right now to sort of frame this topic, right? Like one is what I think about like what GTA did, right? Like so GTA said, okay, well, we've got Grand Theft Auto, we've got a new Grand Theft Auto game coming out. We have this additional content that we sort of like poked at in GTA 4, but we didn't look at very hard, right? Which would be like Chinatown. So we're going to make a Chinatown Wars game. We're going to put it on mobile and it's on handheld and mobile, and it's largely going to be what you expect from a GTA game, although scaled back, right? We can't, obviously we don't have the processing capacity on the mobile device. Obviously we don't have the controls that we would have on a mobile device. You know, we don't have the memory. We can't access your actual game in the same way, but we'll give you an experience that's like GTA, and you see that a lot in a lot of different forms. Like Assassin's Creed has one of those, and I know that Arkham City has one of those. You can see those kind of things, but World of Warcraft didn't do that. Have you played around with the World of Warcraft app?
I have.
What does it do?
Well, you know, the GTA example is interesting because it's more of the same, right? And World of Warcraft is not, and that's the point, right? Back to this whole concept of if you've got different experiences and people using some of these different devices, then you have something for them to come back and talk about, because my experience is different than your experience, is different from your experience, is different from yours, and so on, right? So if it's more of the same, you know, it's boring, and I'm sure the app did, I don't know offhand how well it did. I'm sure it did well.
Theft Auto, I'm sure it did.
Yeah, right. I mean, you know, just the IP is cool, right? So, I mean, fine. I think World of Warcraft was a baby step. I think in allowing you to actually, you know, check what your friends are doing and whether they've got better gear, and well, now I better log on, right? So it's, you know, it's basically trying to get people more engaged in the game when they actually have time to sit down. I actually think they missed an opportunity. Here's kind of an odd thought, right? And by the way, if any of you want to take this and start a startup around it, go for it. Here it is. What I would have done if I were Blizzard is I would have not just created a lookup, but I would have created a guild chat. How many of you had actually played World of Warcraft here, right? Couple? Okay. So how many of you have actually had those guild masters that seem to be on 24/7? I know I did, right? So I wasn't the guild master, but I did know somebody who was on at like 3 in the morning every day, right? So what's interesting about those people is they really take a sort of to them, it really is sort of a family. To them, it's really a project that they take great pride in, right? So if you're sitting there on the subway getting to work in the morning and you want to sit there and chat with your guildies, I think that's a great mobile application. I have no idea why Blizzard didn't do it. Nothing fancy, just simple chat. You've got your guildies, and you can sit there and do a guild chat, or you can sit there and do a private message to somebody, and you can sit there and interact and say, sure, I'll be on later. Why don't we go ahead and raid, you know, Anixia or whatever the case may be. Right?
Actually, one of the most interesting variants on that I heard, I don't know if this was real, this may have just been an idea I heard, is that you could give someone an app where they could be a healer, and they would just get a queue of all the players in the in the battle, and you could just click heal on them.
Right.
Because that's effectively what you do as a healer in World of Warcraft. I mean, you just sort of click heal on the people. So why don't I just give you like a really clean interface where you can just see them and click.
So they can be doing it on the bus while while everybody else is on their computer.
Yeah, exactly. Like it gives you a role. Like if you're like the one of your late 20 friends who has a real job and can't be World of Warcrafting at work, you could just be sitting there with your little application and just clicking heal whenever the things turn red. You know, you have access to that.
Heal in the middle of a meeting.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the kind of thing that's interesting about companion gaming is that like there's no reason, you know, one of the things that comes up, I used to work in browser-based games in terms of MMOs, and one of the things you realize is if you have a server, it doesn't make any difference what the client looks like.
No. Right.
Like it's totally irrelevant what the client looks like. So one of the things that we used to pitch at our old MMO company is that like if an advertising brand wanted to come along and theme our whole world Coke, there's no reason why we would segregate that audience. We just like make their world look like Coke and make your world look the same and make all the game objects the same, and then you just run around in totally different looking worlds with the same experience, and there's absolutely no reason why you couldn't do that. And if you take that to its logical extension, then there's no reason why you couldn't like take the data of a game, whether that in any form, right? Whether that be the kind of chat stuff that you're talking about or even the gameplay, and give you like a lighter, accessible way to get to it. Of course, there's whole other strategies, right? There's like the rage strategy. Right, so with rage, you have this like, you know, you have this I don't know if you followed that one, right? You have a massive AAA post-apocalyptic game, but then on the tablet, which actually I think was a more successful and more attention-getting game, you have basically like a target shooter, you know, like an old-fashioned like railed target shooter, but it's set in the same narrative universe, so it's a way to kind of expose people to that narrative universe more cheaply. I mean,
I was playing Skyrim on the TV, but then it looked like Gauntlet on me iPhone. But we could, if it was an MMO, could that work?
Well, but that's the question.
And I wouldn't mind because I'd see my friends buzzing about, and it would be enough. I'm on my TV, and I see my friend run up to me, and he's just like dragging around because he's on the bus.
Well, yeah. I mean, on the one hand, yes. I think, because, you know, I can feed the data to this device, right? And if I feed the data to this device and I make a display that will work on this device, then yeah, I could be playing Skyrim right now. But the problem is, I don't have a joystick on this device, right? And I don't have a ton of memory on this device.
That's one of many problems.
Yeah, I mean, we just keep going, right? Like I have a screen that's, you know, you can see it, right? It's not that.
Right.
Right.
Well, I kind of always run aground when I get to that. I was playing Skyrim and I was going on adventures and it was awesome. And then I'd have to go back to me, village, sell all my stuff.
Right.
Then go to the training place, the companions train up, then go and buy more stuff, sort it out, line up a new quest, and then I'd go and do that. And I was thinking like all that kind of, homework. You know, that kind of less. Visually impressive and stimulating stuff.
Yeah,
I could have done on my mobile while I was at work or on the way home, just rack up some quests. And so it was like the less intrinsically fun things were sort of being shunted onto the mobile. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that I think back to a point that Eric mentioned earlier. I think really the heart of this whole thing is that like you're trying to design for what's intelligent for the device and the use case, right? Like that's ultimately what's important about the device design. And the problem that I have, you know, like Resident Evil, another really good example, right? So they released the new Resident Evil on the 3DS, and they had to release. And it wasn't, by the way, this wasn't for Resident Evil. There was a Japanese game before this that did this first that they built this thing for, but it's the same problem. We could just imagine that Resident Evil did it. Resident Evil has a camera, and adjusting the movement of the camera is important to the gameplay, but you can't do that on a console system unless you have two analog sticks. It just doesn't work. And they tried to do it by dragging the screen, like tapping and dragging the screen, but it's horrible. It's just like unplayably horrible. So they had to build this whole like side interface. It's actually a clip that attaches to a tab at the top of your 3DS, and then it creates a second joystick for you, right? Yeah.
Which was a horrible idea, in my opinion.
Yeah, and it's not good. I mean, people use it, and it's like they cripple their hands trying to hold that thing. But it's like it's a really interesting problem, right? And I think the Vita is an interesting experiment to try to get around this by like you know the Vita has a touch thing. A multi-touch sensor on the back of the pad, and I think it's a really interesting experiment because what they're trying to do is I mean, I apologize for talking about Sony right in front of you, but what I think is interesting is that like what they're trying to do is basically like put the control in a place where you could actually use it, right?
Right.
Like because like I have to hold the device like this anyway, right? So my fingers are back here, so maybe I can put a control back there in a way to do something, and I think that's like actually a much more elegant way to think about what you're doing. They use that in Katamari Damacy to like you can change scale, right? You like you expand and contract. Like you can see what my fingers are doing, right? You do that. You pinch effectively to change scale, and I think that's kind of interesting. So, to me, what it's really about is it's not so much like I want to take the boring stuff and get it out of the console game Skyrim, although that might be the answer. To me, it's that you know what I really don't want to do on an analog stick is navigate menus. That's horrible.
Yeah. Right.
Right? It's a horrible, horrible experience. There's a reason why Mass Effect went to that circle, right? It's because if I had to do that in a list, it would just be mind-numbingly painful. But like on a mobile phone where I can touch it, lists are easy.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it's simple. And like so pushing off to the other device, the thing that makes sense on the other device, I think is like what is the most logical application of this kind of stuff. And in a game like Skyrim or World of Warcraft, like these very, very large games with many, many components, like I think farming out the content to devices that are natural for them is a good way to get dedicated users to have a more fun experience.
So in your example, and to put sort of generic tags on this, crafting, training, guild operations, those sorts of things, yeah, because that's all, to your point, menu operations. You sit there and go click, 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 right? Right.
You rack up the things to do.
Right.
When you're next in front of your TV, so it's all filtered and there's just loads of good stuff.
Right. And it's interesting that you mentioned the analog stick here, because I would actually love to see a port where maybe instead of using an analog stick, you actually have to move around. I don't know. I don't know if that would be great or if it would suck. I don't. But
well, just, what a great tee off to Greg Trefry in the audience.
Go for it, man.
The design, in some ways you're suggesting that you could approach it from either design or a business angle, right? Like from a, and I guess I can only imagine this happening in an ideal world where it's like, oh, we're going to design a game that is going to have all these different components across these different things and figure out like sort of what's the casual version of Rage. We've got this like shooter, so you kind of how you like, you know, figure out from the very beginning what are all the little parts that it's going to be. How much of that do you think is, you know, is driven by design versus just driven by business part of it? Like, oh, we've got a game, now we want to launch it somewhere else, versus successfully saying, like, let's plan for all of these things and, you know, make a game design which is complex enough that it can be broken up into tiny little pieces. Does that make sense?
I think if your game isn't fun, you don't have a business model that'll work anyway. So I think design has... So I think whatever the business model is, it has to follow the game design. The game has to be fun and cool and has to actually attract user attention, right? And then you just kind of follow from that. Having said that, the smart developers will actually build with a business model in mind, right? To Andrew's point, anybody developing on Facebook that developed a game and all of a sudden had Facebook actually switch its terms of service, well, you know, now I've got to redesign my game. With this, I actually designed from the beginning to account for, you know, whatever the platform limitations are. So I think you focus on product first, and this is true of any business on earth, right? But focus on product first and then figure out all the different ways that you can monetize and then just A-B test and try it out, right? But have an idea, at least a general idea of what your business model is before you start developing the game. So,
and I think the categories that we kind of established in the early part of this conversation, that's why I wanted to start with that, become really useful test case for this, right? So when I think, you know, we're developing some independent IP at my company, and when I think about the rollout strategy for it, right, I very much think that, like, you know, I want to have, when I think about this brand, I want to have as broad a platform as possible. Mm-hmm. We work with technologies deliberately, like Unity and Air, that are portable to multiple devices, so that we can, like, think about, like, okay, how can we get this in as many places as possible? But then when I think about as many places as possible, I start thinking about, like, what the ramifications of that are, right? So, for example, if I'm going to do something that's going to appear, that I intend to appear on PSN and Live Arcade and Steam, there's really no reason for me to make a different version of that game for those different platforms,
right?
Because I'm not assuming that anyone is going to buy all three of those versions. Like, you are probably a PlayStation gamer or an Xbox gamer or a Steam gamer primarily, and you will probably buy the version that you like of those things, because it's the same, essentially the same demographic. But the mobile phone version of my game, well, you might buy a mobile phone version of my game if you already had the PSN version of my game, because you're not going to play your mobile phone when you're playing your PSN. Yes. Playing on the PlayStation.
It's also not that uncommon for people to buy both versions of a mobile game, both the iOS and the Android version, right? Because people have multiple devices. That's and the games are so cheap that 99 cents is no big deal.
So I think that, like, so when I think about, like, that cross platform, I start thinking about it that way, right? So I'm like, okay, well, where do I want a companion experience? Well, I don't want a companion experience that's different. I probably want a single release, unless I have some kind of exclusive. I want a single release across hardcore platforms that's tailored to those hardcore platforms, but fundamentally the same game, right? Maybe there's some exclusive content to different places if you want to jazz it up, or you want to have a certain kind of business arrangement, but you're not going to, like, fundamentally redesign the game for Steam. Like, I'm not going to try to think about what my game could be that would be different, like the right manifestation for the PC, because all I'm going to do is make it work with a mouse and keyboard or whatever the control scheme is. But when I think about the mobile device, I'm going to say to myself, oh, wait, well, what would actually make sense to do in my game on mobile, and how could I make an experience that someone is likely to buy even if they already own the previous game? Now, I think Rockstar tried to do that by creating content that was only available, which I think is a, you know, it's not a bad strategy, but, like, you're assuming that people will play GTA on their phones, which I think is a dangerous thing. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have the brand weight of a GTA behind you, I think it's a very dangerous thing.
Right.
But that said, I think that's why that kind of categorization is useful. It's useful to think about, like, especially with something like Facebook, right? Like I can't tell you how many times people have tried to make MMOs for Facebook, like, just straight up MMOs for Facebook. Like, how many times, and how many times this has failed? Like, people do not want to play World of Warcraft or Star Wars: The Old Republic on Facebook, and this is just, I think this is just, like, devastatingly clear after the number of failures that have happened. But that doesn't mean you can't have an Old Republic experience on Facebook. Right. You just can't make the MMO for Facebook because the Facebook audience doesn't want it.
Yes, exactly. Well, the Facebook audience, we're looking at a demographic that we've never seen in gaming before. You know, I mean, we're looking at the 45-year-old mom demographic that has never played a video game ever. And then all of a sudden they're getting sucked into games that they're getting sucked into a gaming experience that they never expected to get into. So it's a great point. Facebook is not interested in that kind of a game.
And yet, there's another dimension to it that's kind of interesting. Take a game. How many of you have heard of a game called Runes of Magic? Anybody? Okay, so it's a free-to-play game, right? So, okay, two people, including one panelist. So it's a free-to-play web game, essentially. It's an immersive MMO. Okay, the team that developed the original Runes of Magic is working on a sort of a sequel or another one. I don't know if they're going to call it Runes of Magic. But what's interesting is they put out a Facebook game, and it's not an immersive MMO because, to Nick's point, MMOs on Facebook fail. We know that. But what's interesting about it is that it's a very simple sort of turn-based strategy game, and they're experimenting with new IP, right? So this simple turn-based game actually happens a couple of years into the future after the original MMO. And so they're experimenting with a couple of creatives, right? Some of that may make it into the next game. Some of it may not. So maybe it's a test bed. It's similar to how, like, you know how electronics all come out in Japan first? Because it's actually a big enough market to where you can actually study it carefully. But it's a small enough market to where if you fail, it's not like a huge rollout in the U.S. where it's very costly. So it's the same thing. It's a less costly way to test IP rather than to piss off your core gamers, essentially.
And just as a note, this is an aside. I don't think it's really... It's not so relevant to this conversation, but I think it's an interesting note on that topic is that, you know, Disney has recently done this with an iPhone game mm-hmm. called Where's My Water, where they introduced a brand new character. Like, and that was the point. Like, if you read the designer's notes on that game, they basically say that, like, our intention was to create a compelling character in a with fun gameplay. So Disney, it tried a strategy where they just decided to roll out a whole new narrative universe, but they used an innovative iOS game to perform that. And that game has performed very well. It's in the top 10 on the iOS list. And they're now rolling out webisodes of the characters. And I wouldn't be surprised if Disney continues to, because it's Disney and they're good at this, they continue to just exploit that IP up
the
chain.
They will soon have 12 movies.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So,
yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Because they know they can.
So we have about 15 minutes left, a little less now, 14, which is about the time that I would start asking for questions. So if there's anything we haven't covered, this is a good chance to dive in.
Point. Do you think that the reason, so I don't think there's been a really like awesome sort of brand that's kind of delivered a joined up experience on all the different devices, right? Like it's always a companion app, it's always an afterthought, it's always tagged on, mm-hmm. right? And it never, and so do you think like to think for designers to actually think this is going, rather than release, design it for one device and then 6 months later think about how to roll it out onto another. If they could think about what the whole experience was from the very start, someone might come up with that.
Yeah. Actually, I mean, the answer to the question is yes. I think that the problem is that a small developer can't really do that. Because a small developer probably doesn't have the resources in-house and probably doesn't have the talent in-house to develop on all those platforms simultaneously.
Yep.
But a brand producer should. And I think that we're just now starting to see on the side of licensors and awareness that, like, hey, if I'm going to release Spider-Man stuff, I want to think about my whole strategy from the beginning.
Right.
And that as that matures, I think that you're going to start to see more and more of these kind of experiences happen. I think a lot of the reason why it's still early is that we have to remind ourselves as ubiquitous as the iPad is now, it's really new. And people are only just starting to figure out, like, what that device is and how it's used, and there's a lot of questions about like what its position is in the gaming marketplace, and like, is it going to kill a laptop? You know, like it hurt netbook sales, but what other sales is it hurting? It's like there's an interesting question about where it's going to be situated. So I think that will develop over time. The other piece of this that makes it easier is that we're just now starting to see technologies that are reliable gaming technologies that can be used across platform, yeah. right? So Unity is a big deal.
That's totally. Very important.
Very big deal, huge. Right? The idea that Unity can port, I mean, people here familiar with Unity? People are familiar with Unity? Okay. So Unity is a software tool that's made for, it's like a simple game-focused 3D engine physics set that facilitates rapid development. You can make 2D stuff in it too, although that's not as robust yet. But what's really interesting about Unity and Unity's strategy is that Unity has taken a very early and dedicated approach to cross-platform release. So you can build to Unity right now. You can build from Unity right now to all the major AAA consoles, iOS, Android, on both parameters, PC, Mac, and Flash. And they will, for you, although they won't give you the ability to do this yourself, port it to, like, Symbian.
Right.
So I mean, it's a really powerful tool for that stuff. And HTML5, similar vein, Air, similar vein. A lot of people are moving in that direction, so we'll see more of that stuff happening.
That can't be stressed enough, too. Start with a goal, basically. I'll give you one example of a game that was well-intentioned and didn't really start with a focused goal, right? So Zynga does some great things. I think Farmville on mobile was kind of a flop. Why? Because it doesn't really add anything. So imagine this. You're sitting in front of Facebook. You farm. You sit there. You have to wait for 8 hours for your eggplant to, like, ripen or whatever the case may be. Being able to actually sit there and check on my crops on a mobile phone gives me nothing. So I think they did it basically because, well, everybody's moving to mobile, so let's do it too. And I think they've become more sophisticated as a result afterwards. But it basically hit the top 10 charts. It disappeared, and then you never heard from it again. And that's why. No goal. It just, let's be on mobile because everybody's on mobile. Well, all right. Think about it first. So, yeah.
Just kind of to go back to a little bit of what you said, just to play off of that. But I think a lot of the reasons why it comes as an afterthought as well is because one of the resources that Nick was talking about, but also a lot of the big companies and a lot of the big distributors, they want to keep everything in their own kind of little world. And I don't necessarily know how, on a business side, logistically, how well they are at helping independents plan for a multi-platform strategy release that extends beyond their own platform.
Yeah.
So I think that has to do with it a lot as well. And then, you know, anytime you kind of do a multi-platform release, it just takes so much more effort, even on the business side, to do that and deal with each of the little cultures for each of the platform holders, whether you're doing mobile or you're doing console. One of the things that I was interested in hearing about was the idea of not just cross-platform releases, but the idea of cross-play and doing things like that. Like the Wii U is supposed to come out where you be able to have a group of people playing on a television screen, but as well as having the secondary screen of the Wii U device. So even though that's within its own ecosystem, what about the idea of cross-play with mobile devices and a console? You guys talk about categorization of devices, like, okay, a console is a very immersive experience, mobile's very separate. I kind of disagree with that. I think that, you know, if you have people sharing devices in the house, there are opportunities in which you can have people be engaged with one single brand in different ways. So depending on what you're playing.
Nintendo's been a leader at this, yeah. Right? There's a Scrabble game you can play with your iPad where you can have your letter tiles on your iPhone.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
Yep. Which I love to death because it's let me get the number right in my head. It's a $1,600 game of Scrabble. Right? I mean, because like, it's all of a sudden a $300 iPhone, and then we have to have like a $400 iPad on the table. So it's a little bit, and I think that therein lies the problem, right? There's this sort of if you can get an ubiquity to the devices, it makes sense. I mean, the best example of this, my favorite example of all time, was Four Swords for the GameCube. Mm-hmm. Was awesome. You would play Four Swords. So Four Swords is a version of Zelda where there's like four links running around.
Yep.
And so it's sort of like Gauntlet. You like all fight and then you kill things, but then there are gems and you can fight over the gems to compete between each other. And the way that Four Swords worked is you would all run around on this big screen, but if you entered into like a house or a cave, you would move to your DS.
Yep. Crystal Chronicles did the same thing. Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicles did the same thing.
And that was awesome because then you would play a little bit on your DS and you'd go back. There's also a game that released with the with the GameCube called Pac-Man Versus, where three of the players play Ghost chasing Pac-Man around on the big screen, and then one player plays Pac-Man. Like, and it actually looks like Pac-Man, which is the most awesome thing about that game. It looks like Pac-Man, and they're playing it on their DS. And I think that stuff is amazing. It's an amazing experience. I think the trick is there's an ubiquity of devices that needs to be assumed.
Right.
And Nintendo could never... And because Nintendo never got its wireless communication right, like you had to get this extra cable, and it was just like... It was all such a headache. I think that... If we can get to the point where the devices can just Bluetooth connect and you're not really thinking about it anymore, which I think we can do right now. We have the technology, right? And we can get an ubiquity of either... We know that everybody has an iPhone and everybody has an iPad and we're okay, or the iPad doesn't care if it's an iPhone or Android device or a Vita or a 3DS or whatever. It's just going to take it. Then I can think you can start to see those experiences growing up in a real way.
Yeah, that was the biggest challenge. I remember we tried to play Crystal Chronicles back in college, and it's an awesome game. But getting four people together that all had a Game Boy
Advance?
Game Boy Advance.
Yeah.
Trying to find four people that had a Game Boy Advance was really, really hard. Yeah. And getting all those four people in the same room at one time was unbelievably difficult.
Yeah. By the time you had, you just wanted to do something
exactly.
else anyway. You're like, hey, I haven't seen you for ages.
Yeah.
But there are a number of mobile games that are designed around these sort of ad hoc networks, right? One of my favorites was you know, Greg and I, Corona Festival, called Come Out and Play, and there was a game in the Come Out and Play San Francisco version run by Catherine Hurdley called Seek and Spell, where they just sort of like drop letters into space, but you start a game just by like being around a bunch of people and being like, hey, let's start. And there's no reason why you couldn't do that in a cross-device way. And I think that when we are able to do it in a more cross-device way, it's going to be even more powerful.
Yeah.
So before you mentioned that Facebook gamers are 45-year-old women primarily, and I just wanted to get your take on what about the 18-plus male Facebook gamer? Like, is that a myth? Are they out there? Like, what's going on with that crowd?
No, they're absolutely out there. My point earlier wasn't that the only gamers on Facebook are 45-year-old women, but that we're actually seeing demographics on Facebook that we've never seen in the gaming space before. No, there's plenty. I mean, you know, what we're finding on Facebook is that practically everybody on Facebook plays a game, right, you know, of some type. So yeah, there is any demographic, any interest, anything you're trying to find on Facebook is there.
If I was 21
in the gaming environments.
If I'm a 21-year-old male, what am I playing on Facebook?
Well, the Mafia War style games are probably the, you know, the most popular. When we were developing games back in late 2007, all of the 21-year-old guys were playing, you know, the poker app, right? Zynga's poker app, as you would expect.
Right.
So they tend to follow the demographics that you would expect them to.
The way games are structured on Facebook to be very driven by the sort of motive use of like, oh, I use it for a little bit, then I go away and come back. Do the sort of more hardcore gamer sets still use it in that same way, or what does their motive use look like?
Well, the games are actually designed primarily. You know, a lot of the games are designed to be that, right? I mean, if you look at the Farmville style game, any of the virtual currency style games, they're designed to give you 5 minutes of interaction and then make you wait. And that's part of why the games are so addicting, is that you can't play for 4 hours straight and burn out like you can with console games. You get 5 minutes, and then you have to sit there and wait for your crops to grow, or wait for, you know, the next step in the game, and then you've got to come back to get your fix, right? And that's what the waiting is actually one of the best monetization mechanisms in that type of environment, because people hate waiting. And if you give them the opportunity to earn the next step in the game, to earn more currency, to earn the next virtual good just by, you know, paying for it or interacting with an ad in some way, you know, then you've got a great business model.
I suspect they address two different needs too, and I'll preface what I'm about to say by saying I have absolutely no statistics behind this at all. This is a total total gut feeling, but here it is. I think you play on a console to basically beat your buddies into the ground. And I think think about a 20-year-old male. What do they think about? Girls, right? That's where I think a lot of it is driving Facebook, right? They're using a lot of it to basically date, right?
Show off.
Show off. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so it's a very different – so there's two different needs. So, yes, I think bottom line, I think to your question, you will find them on Facebook and on mobile and on consoles, but I think you'll find them behaving very differently.
We have 2 minutes left. Anybody want to ask anything else in the remaining 2 minutes?
Think they're going to be successful with that?
Someone has to get these things linked together better, right? Facebook wants to be the one to do it. And yes, they might. That thing is buggy as hell right now. Like, I mean, it is amazing how broken that thing is right now. But it'll get fixed pretty quick. And once it is fixed, I'm really curious to see whether that becomes a central point. But I think, I mean, again, it gets back to the Facebook credits. If Facebook credits are basically QQ, which I never thought of that before, but that's totally, you're right. Absolutely right. They were trying to be QQ.
Yeah.
QQ is the... is the Chinese currency that's like that can be used instead of money in many places?
Yeah.
Then I can see basically Facebook trying to replace Game Center, right? Effectively, and just say like, no, just do everything through Facebook. Like, see, here you can link up. I don't know. It's an interesting question. I think there's the big question of mobile to me right now is, where is the Android market going to come?
Right.
Like, where is that going to land? Because the Android market doesn't cut it right now. And it might someday, but there's really a huge opportunity for someone to come in and like lock that space up. And that's the dominant platform for smartphones in the country, and it's a growing platform. Like the iPhone is settling into its normal 20% range that most Apple devices have. They got 70% of tablets, and I don't know if that's going to change because the iPad feels like an iPod in that it's salting the earth, so only iPads will grow. But Android has a huge opportunity to grow, and I think everybody's just kind of waiting for like someone on the transaction end of how these apps get in front of people to get it right, and then that whole thing's going to blow up.
Yeah.
And maybe that'll be Facebook.
Presenting last night. And they would position themselves in that way as well. They're saying, we're coming into the US market, and we'll handle the monetization, engagement, and retention, give you all these APIs, you know, just like OpenFaint and Papaya Mobile. So
yep.
They're all going for that. And Zynga announced they're going to be a platform as well. It's interesting.
Yeah.
But I think Facebook's currently selling it on the idea that we can join up all your users between the two devices.
Yeah, but then the joining of users thing is always... That's always a hairy thing, right? Because some people want it and some people don't, and who wants to own their audience and who doesn't want to own their audience, and like gets very tricky. And if you try to do cross-platform development between Game Center and Android things, it gets, you know, you basically jeopardize your placement. It's like it's funny because it's not a technical problem. No. Technically, it's simple. It's easier, honestly. But it's always it's a problem of like what the platforms are going to allow. Like Apple has absolutely
posturing.
Yeah. Apple has no interest whatsoever in letting you play your game on an Apple device with
anywhere
else. Yeah,
right.
Like they don't want you to do that. Yeah. And it runs aground of like every developer instinct to just congregate all the communities into one place. So there's. Yeah. So get an iPhone.
Right.
Apple's response is get an iPhone.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's the problem.
Yeah, that's their take on it. And it's probably, well, I mean, that's why they're never going to get larger than 20%, but I also think Apple's okay with that.
Yeah.
I mean, Apple's goal in all of this is to be the best gaming platform, not the biggest. So
Apple can't stop that happening.
Oh yeah. Well, what they'll do is they'll shut you out of Game Center.
Right.
They'll ban your app, which they
do. They've already done some of this, right? They were threatening to kick people off of the platform who were using I forget the name of the service that it was, but there was a design service that allowed you to port it to multiple devices, and Apple actually said, we're not going to let you do that. And there was such a big stink over it that they finally backed down. But they were actually going to say, like, you either design for a native iOS app, or you don't get onto the device.
Yeah, here's
that was iOS. Unity, actually. Yeah.
Was it Unity?
Yeah,
it
yeah.
Unity.
Yeah. Well, and there's a neat fact about Adobe, right? So, like, I happen to know this because the CTO that I worked with last decompiled Flash when he got frustrated with it. And we found something interesting, which is that... Apple made this big, big stink about Flash being on the device because Flash runs slowly on the device. Yep. The reason why Flash runs slowly on the device is because the way it calls memory is the bad way to call memory. It's like the wrong way to call memory on the iPhone. There's another way to call memory that works perfectly fine, and if you get Flash to do that, Flash runs great on the iPhone. But they deliberately made Adobe, they forced Adobe into the corner where their memory usage sucked to cripple Flash on the device, and then basically claim that Flash didn't work, which was amazing. I mean, it was an amazing step, but it's like, why did it... The last thing Apple wants is Flash to work on the device. Right. If you could play free web games on your iPhone, why would you buy apps?
Yeah,
right.
Right? So, like, that's the last thing on earth they want. And so that's the thing, is that, like, there's this utopian view of how you can congregate communities, which I guess is kind of a nice dark note to end this panel on. Like, there's a utopian view of how you can congregate communities that every developer on the face of the planet wants. And we've wanted it for years. We wanted it back when it was, like, Yahoo versus AOL. And we had to basically have this big fight about whether we could, like, get our games to, like, talk to the Yahoo users when we were on AOL. And the answer was no. We couldn't. Even though, to our servers, they're just different tags. Right. So you know, there's limitations on this strategy, but I think that as certainly as more open technology spread and as people on the on the platform side become more interested in openness, you're going to see these things grow and grow and grow. And particularly now, like we said, because Unity exists and HTML5 is coming like a storm. It's still a faraway storm, by the way.
Yeah.
HTML5 is not there yet, but but it's coming. As those things come, it's just going to get easier and easier, and hopefully we'll see that day come.
Apple's going to have to figure out how to kick HTML5 off of iOS.
Yeah, good luck going there. Back to different standards on different
computers.
I think we're over on time, unfortunately. So thank you.
We can.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.